You may think Kenny G is cool, you may not, but here's something we can all agree on. The smooth jazz artist has sold 14 gazillion albums and is playing to two sold-out shows this weekend with the Kansas City Symphony at the Kauffman Center, and a third show has just been added. He has a certain perspective on himself as well. He's an affable guy who knows when to laugh at himself. Check out his appearance in this commercial for Snickers candy bars.
Jake, tell the story, man. The story is horrible.
Jake, have some Snickers bites, because you're kind of a buzzkill when you're hungry, man.
The idea there, whenever one of the poker players gets hungry, he turns into a buzzkill, and suddenly it's like Kenny G at the poker table. So eat new Snicker bites and be yourself all over again. Kenny G is considered the biggest-selling instrumentalist of the modern era, with global sales topping not 14 gazillion, but actually 75 million records. And welcome to Up to Date, Kenny. Nice to have you today.
Hey, Steve. Nice to be with you.
You were such a good sport to make that Snickers ad. Why did you do it?
Well, you know, when you get national exposure, first of all, I wasn't being such a good sport. It's good for me too, you know, to be out there. Yeah, when you know, the radio stations and the record stores and the way that people get to hear about my music is so limited, as opposed to the way it used to be. So this is good for me to be out there and just to get some exposure. And I also, you know, I like a sense of humor. So if something's funny, whether it's at my expense or anybody else's expense, if it's truly funny, it's good. It's good with me.
Well, you do take a lot of ribbing. Does it ever get tough for you or not?
I don't really consider myself getting a lot of ripping, but because I actually don't pay attention to it. You know, if I listened to what people had told me, I wouldn't be talking to you right now, because there would be no career. I would just be, you know, listening to the advice of everybody else that's always told me that you can't do this, an instrumentalist can only do that, this song's too simple, blah, blah, blah.
Well, you said, you just referred to it already here this morning, Kenny, this notion, as you talked about on HuffPost yesterday, that an instrumentalist like yourself will never again sell as many records as you did back in the 90s. Why is that, and how has the Internet and all of that changed everything for us?
Well, I say never, but I'm hopefully that never, you know, you never say never.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, theoretically, you could get downloads more than what was sold back in the 90s, but that, you know, theoretically, it hasn't proven itself yet, because even the biggest pop stars are not selling what they used to sell. The difference, and this is just my opinion. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people about it. I don't know if they agree with me, but the way I look at it is that the audience that likes my particular music is a more mature audience that isn't necessarily taking the time to just go ahead and search out things, download music, and so. If they're not searching me out, I'm having trouble reaching them. I didn't used to have trouble reaching them, because pop radio was very, you could reach a lot of people by being on pop radio, and they would play my music. So that doesn't work like that anymore, and it's really tough to reach people. There's no record stores, so people have to buy their music at Walmart's, Best Buy, Target, and there's so many more things in those stores than music.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you miss the old days, or do you find all this new stuff discouraging at all?
I miss part of the old days. I like the fact that you can download music. I do like that, because for me, when I'm trying to check out right now I'm working on a new Bossa Nova record. It's all Bossa Novas. It's going to be songs like Stan Getz and Cannonball Adderley and Paul Desmond did in the 50s, so I'm really checking out their music. I can go and download a song right away and hear it. I don't have to drive down to Tower Records and find it. So that's really good. I like that part. The part I don't like is the fact that there really is no romance when it comes to buying music anymore. I used to love to go and walk down. I mean, I say that I like the convenience, but I also really enjoyed going into Tower Records, talking to people, listening to what was new. And the thing about that is that it's like going into the grocery store when you want a loaf of bread, but you come out with a basket full of groceries. When you go into a record store, let's say you only want an Elton John record, you'll come out with 10 different records. You'll talk to people and you'll hear things, and those days are gone.
Yeah, I agree with you. I miss that completely, being able to walk into a store and actually have a conversation with people and check out what they're getting and get some recommendations, and you just can't help but think those days are sort of gone, aren't they?
Yeah, unfortunately, and that was a big part, I think, of my success, was that fortunately for me, when people were asking about music, my music was talked about. It was played in the record store. You heard it on the radio. There might have been an ad in the paper. All that stuff. You know, the President Clinton said I was his favorite musician. That kind of exposure, you know, it's like, it's really great. And if you have all of that and it all happens at the same time and you have Clive Davis and Arista Records backing you up and, you know, there's a lot you can do, and I maximized on that.
Hmm. I should point out that Kenny G performs this weekend with the Kansas City Symphony as part of the orchestra's pop series. Shows on Friday and Saturday are sold out, but tickets for Sunday's 7 p.m. performance are still available. You'll find more details at kcur.org and at the symphony's website, kcsymphony.org. You know, Kenny, how can a guy who's sold as many records as you have for as many years as you have still be considered as controversial in the music world as you are?
I don't know. Am I considered controversial?
Well, sure. Sure you are.
I mean, in what way? What are you referring to?
Well, I'll refer to Pat Metheny, you know, our local jazz hero here from Lee Summit, Missouri, just near Kansas City, just inaugurated into the Downbeat Magazine Hall of Fame. You know, he's not a big fan, and he wrote some things about you a little while back that I wanted you to respond to really quickly. Pat Metheny wrote this: he's not really an advanced player, referring to you. Your harmonic and melodic vocabulary is extremely limited, he said. You played sharp. You did know how to connect to a crowd, but even then there were lots of harmonic clams in what you played. What about all that from Pat Metheny?
He's obviously on drugs.
Because why?
I mean, first of all, the fact that you would say something like that publicly means that you have no sense of what right and wrong is. So he had to have been high or something. Anyway, I looked at that as like somebody just got off on the wrong side of the bed and just didn't know what to do with himself that day.
But what about what he said? Do you dispute it all? Is he just flat out wrong?
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah. He's do you want me to critique his playing? I can do that too, but I would never do it publicly.
Well, give me 10 seconds of that. I mean, what would you say about his playing?
I wouldn't say anything. He's a great player. You know, he's a great player. I would say that publicly, but that doesn't mean I'm going to say exactly those words privately if I'm talking to other musicians that I'm sharing my comments with. I don't love everything about every musician that's played, you know, but the thing that I do know is what I do every day, is which is this. I'm practicing every day. That's what I do 3 hours a day. So
not bad, Kenny.
If you want to take all those notes and you want to analyze all those notes and tell me that my technique is no good, then go ahead and do that. But it won't mean anything to me.
Well, in fairness to Pat, he's acknowledged there's a lot of jealousy in the music world and a lot of jealousy directed at someone as successful as you are. How much of all these kinds of comments can be laid at the feet of this notion of jealousy, Kenny?
Probably most of them. I mean, just obviously that's. But by the way, who cares what Pat Metheny says? Honestly,
well,
I could care less what he says about my music. So it's meaningless to me. All those things are meaningless. It's the main thing that a musician is supposed to do is play what they feel is their sound. That's my main idea of what I work on every day, is practicing, trying to get my sound, whatever my sound is. I try to do what feels right to me. So when I'm practicing something, when I'm playing a song, when I'm composing, when I'm performing, I just do what feels right to me. And there's no point in me listening to other commentary about it, because then I'm not being true to who I am. And I think that's really important. So it's meaningless, all that stuff that you're talking about.
Kenny, let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk about your career. Let's walk through it a little bit and some of the highlights, and particularly some of the absolutely amazing people you've performed with over the years: Aretha, Whitney Houston, Natalie Cole, and even Frank Sinatra and Barbara Streisand. Let's do that. And in the meantime, let's take a break. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Thank you. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation with National Book Award finalist George Saunders, he wrote 10th of December. You can find that in all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, with the recent NFL lawsuit, the problem of concussions is front page news. We'll look at treatment and prevention programs for young folks. Plus, we'll have our weekend to-do list with Brian McTavish. Well, this hour, visiting with Kenny G, the best-selling instrumentalist in history. He sold more than 75 million records. Kenny, let's talk about, as I mentioned before the break, some of the folks you've worked with: Aretha, Whitney Houston, Natalie Cole, Frank Sinatra. Give me a quick snapshot of what it was like working with some of these folks. And let's start with Aretha Franklin. Tell us about her.
Well, I've met her a few times at some of the industry gatherings, yeah, the Grammys or whatever they are. And she's sweet. You know, she was nice to me. And I got the call from her producer at the time, which was Narada Michael Walden. They wanted me to do a solo on one of her songs. And so I think that was actually one of the very first solos I did for a real big star. And I was flattered and, you know, went in the studio and just did my thing, and it was awesome. Easy.
When you played with her, I'm putting quotes around the word with, were you actually in the studio with her, or did you do something long distance like sometimes happens these days?
Well, it wasn't, in those days, it wasn't like we all had our own studios and we could dial in the music. I was actually in the studio that the producer was working in, which was up in the Bay Area, I think. Mm-hmm. So I had to go up there to do it, but no, she wasn't in the studio.
How about working with Whitney Houston?
We toured together in, I think it was 1987 or 88. We did a national tour together. We did about 50 or 60 dates together. It was super fun for me. You know, I had sold some records, but I wasn't anywhere like in Whitney's league at that point.
Yeah.
But I had done pretty well. So we did. We were playing for like 20, 25,000 people, and it was a big tour for me. So I enjoyed it. The hard part about that tour was that she was surrounded by some really protective guys, and they had, you know, they were always giving me and my band like orders on what we could or couldn't do, and that wasn't sitting well with me. So we just told them flat out, we're just not going to listen to any of that stuff. And at that point, from then on, we got along pretty well.
Were you able to become friends with Whitney? Did you have that kind of access to her, or was it kind of like two separate worlds orbiting around each other?
You know, she was not easily accessible because she was so protected by her guys.
Mm-hmm.
I think she didn't really, she probably didn't care that much, but they did. So I saw her every now and then as she would walk down the hallway from her dressing room somewhere. We would say hi to each other. She was very approachable, but she just wasn't accessible.
Back in the 90s, you recorded with Frank Sinatra. What was that like?
Again, that was, you know, the producer sent me... I think Phil Ramone was the producer at that point, and he just sent me the music. And that at that point, I had a studio in my house. He sent me the tapes, you know, not discs, but tapes back in those days. And I put them up in my studio, and I played some music on that song for them, and then sent it back to them, and they used what they liked.
Well, you two came out with the song All the Way, One for My Baby and One More for the Road. Two songs sort of merged together. Let's listen to the end of that song. This is Kenny G with the great Frank Sinatra.
That's how it goes. And Joe, I know you're getting anxious to close. So thanks for the cheer. I hope you didn't mind my bending your ear. But this torch that I found, it's got to be drowned, or it soon might explode. So make it one for my baby and one more for the road. That long, man, it's long, it's a long, long
You know, Kenny, given a choice between recording with someone like Frank Sinatra, you know, side by side, and recording it the way you did sort of in your own studio and he did his own thing somewhere else, what would you prefer?
Well, I would have rather been in the studio with Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
Awesome. That would have been amazing. And that way I could have asked him if he wanted to call Pat Metheny and ask him for his advice on whether I played good enough for his record.
Touche, Kenny.
There you go.
Yeah. I mean, in a situation like that, you know, as an artist of your stature, are you able to sort of say, hey, I'd like to, you know, meet Frank and be in the studio with him? Do you do that, or is that just not how it's done?
No, you could do that. But at that point in my career, when I got some, I mean, Phil Ramone, like this famous producer, sending me a Frank Sinatra, you know, master tape to play on, like, I'm not gonna say anything except, yes, sir. Okay, where do you want me to play exactly?
Yeah.
But basically, the hard part about that was Phil said, just look, just put this stuff on and play the way wherever you hear the holes, play whatever you want to play. So I did like three or four different, you know, let's say takes, mm-hmm. and I sent them in, and then they took what they wanted from that. So, but that sounded great to me. I was listening to that, and I haven't heard it for a while, and I really enjoyed the what I liked about it was that the notes were just the right subtle notes to complement his vocal without like overshadowing or trying to, you know, because you don't want to fill up every hole and sound like you're looking for, you know, exposure. You want to, for me as a, when I'm playing with a vocalist, I want to complement what they're doing and not, I don't want to take away from it. I just want it to be a 1+1=5, not a 1+1 is look at me. You know, I don't want that.
Or visiting
I have enough space in my own CDs for where I can play my own thing. So for them, sure. It's really about them.
We're visiting with saxophonist Kenny G. You know, you were only 17, Kenny, when you landed a gig with Barry White and his Love Unlimited Orchestra at the Paramount Northwest Theater, the old Paramount Northwest Theater up in Seattle. How did you get going with Barry White?
Wow. My very first gig, I was in high school, and we had this cool guy from the Bay Area. His name was Jim Gardner, and he was a composer in residence at our public, you know, high school. So, you know, we were really into, you know, supporting the arts back then. And he was having a conversation with somebody that was the contractor for Barry White coming to Seattle and playing in the Northwest, Seattle, Vancouver, Portland. And the guy was saying, "Oh yeah, the sax player is sick; he can't make it. But we need somebody that can do this gig." And the thing about the gig was you had to be able to read music, and you also had to be able to improvise in a soulful style.
Mm-hmm.
And the high school I went to was a very interracial school. It was an inner-city school. So the music I grew up with was more R&B music, and so my sense of melody was always skewed towards R&B. And the composer at residence said, "Hey, I got this kid that could probably do the gig for you," and they let me have it.
I mean, gee, you ever get a sense of what kind of sway the great Barry White had with women? Because I've read that it was just something to behold.
Well, I was only 17. I didn't really have much contact with him. You know, I was really just playing in the orchestra, and I had lots of solos, which was really fun. So I got a lot of exposure, and for me, it was just kind of like, wow, wait a minute, I just played a professional gig, and everybody seemed to think I did well. So I think I could probably do this, and it just gave me the confidence to go on and become a pro in the music, you know.
Well, and then after that, you began recording on your own in the early 1980s. When did you begin to get a sense that you were going to make it, Kenny? What was there a moment or a contract where you thought, okay, I've crossed the line here. I'm going to get there.
Well, gosh, you know, I could say that I'm still waiting.
I'm
still working hard.
Yeah.
But if I have to answer that, it would be probably when I was on the Johnny Carson show. That's when I knew that things were going to change for me.
What kind of reception did that kind of audience get you?
Well, it was a funny circumstance because my manager at the time was George Benson's manager, and he was obviously at that point the biggest instrumentalist in the world. And my manager pretty much strong-armed the people at Johnny Carson to let me play because they wanted George Benson because he was so sought after.
Mm-hmm.
And my manager, you know, he's doing his manager thing. You know, if you want George Benson, you got to let this kid play on the Johnny Carson show. And they went, ugh, who needs a sax player to play on there? But he made it happen. And the thing was, we at that point we had a single, which was called What Does It Take to Win Your Love, this Junior Walker tune. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you know that tune, but
no.
Let's see if I can play. I can't remember how it goes. Da 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 da. Anyway, I can play it if I had a few minutes to remember it. But
yeah.
It was a very popular song. Anyway, it was doing very well, and that's the song they wanted me to play on Johnny Carson, which was a vocal song, and I had a sax solo in there. And to me, I never really liked the fact that that was the philosophy in those days. And I mean, remember, this was early '80s, so this was mid '80s. The philosophy was they're not going to play instrumentals on pop radio, so you got to do a vocal, play your sax solo. And eventually they'll realize that you're not the singer, but you're the saxophones. And I said, well, how are they going to know I'm not the singer when it has my name, play a song, and it's all about the vocal?
Hmm.
No, that's not the way it's going to work. So I hated that idea. But, you know, I'm with Arista Records, and I'm trying to do my best to keep my record deal. So I'm figuring out how to balance what I want to do with what they want to do, and it wasn't really working for me. So what happened with Johnny Carson was when the curtain went up, I played one of my instrumentals instead.
Mm-hmm.
Totally against everybody's advice. You know, like I was telling you earlier, if you listen to what people tell you, you got to do what you think is right. So
right.
Curtain goes up, I play this one. My song Songbird, I play that. And everyone's completely upset with me. The Johnny Carson people are mad at me because I didn't play what they wanted. Record company was mad because I didn't support the single. Johnny Carson didn't know anything about this. He looked over at me, gave me a thumb, like one of those okay signs,
yeah,
you know,
right.
Johnny Carson would do.
Yeah.
And I was just happy as a clam because I did what I wanted to do on Johnny Carson. But it turns out that the viewership, the people watching, loved what they heard, and they started to call in and find out what that song was. And then, you know, Arista, I have to give my hat off to Clive. Clive admitted that they made a mistake, and they changed the single to this Songbird, and that's why it became popular, and that's what made my career.
That's a great story. And again, in those days, instrumentalists weren't supposed to make it, right? It was vocalists that were the thing, and you're going against the grain all this time.
All this time. Even before that moment, against the grain. You know, you got to do vocals. And there were no radio stations that were supporting instrumental music at the time. Because of that song Songbird, because it started to get popular on all these pop stations, then somebody had an idea, hey, let's do a radio station where we play instrumental music. And then what they referred to as smooth jazz stations, those started to come up in like the 86, 87, and a lot of it had to do with the popularity of that particular song. So, you know, it was a big deal that I took that chance, that Arista Records took that chance.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they really got behind me when they realized that there might be something there. Clive was very much in my corner at that point.
You know, if you fast forward then just a few years to 1992, your album Breathless sold 12 million copies in the U.S. alone. How come, Kenny? What sparked that album at the time?
Well, I mean, you can never really answer for people and ask them why they're moved enough to buy music. You know, there's got to be something in the melody, something in the tone, something in the what it makes their hearts feel, and they just wanted to have it. Besides that part, you know, I had, again, the support of radio was just that radio was on fire at that point. Smooth jazz was very popular, pop radio. Everybody was playing my songs, and I was on every show. I was on the Johnny Carson show. I was on all those morning shows. So I got tons of exposure, and, you know, that's how I was on Oprah. I mean, those are the kind of things you need to do and where you can reach so many people, and they just responded because something in the music moved them enough to go and go down to the record stores that existed and go
yeah.
and buy the records.
Let's listen just to a little bit from Breathless. This is Forever in Love.
Thank you.
again, going fast forward here just by a little bit, in 2004, you came out with At Last, the Duets album, and this featured you with a whole host of stars, including Barbra Streisand. And again, I've just got to ask, how was it working with Barbra Streisand?
Well, now that's fun. Oh, by the way, the song you just played, we'll be doing that with the orchestra this weekend.
This weekend, yeah.
And it sounds so good. The fun thing about doing the shows with a great orchestra is that, you know, we normally don't have orchestra because, you know, we do normally do our shows with the band. But when we have the orchestra, it's just so amazing how much better the songs sound with that beautiful orchestration behind it. It's going to be a great concert. So I'm super excited to hear that with the orchestra. But Barbra and I, we met at some fundraiser for something, and we just started talking, and David Foster, the producer, was also a friend of hers, and so he kind of was the catalyst that put us together and asked me if I would do something with her, like play with her somewhere. And I remember going over to her house, and she wanted me to play with one of her songs, and she was playing me this song of hers where Stevie Wonder was playing the solo and on his recorder, whatever you call it, harmonica.
Yeah.
And she said to me, I want you to play like that. I said, well, you realize that that is not the same instrument I play. So, I mean, I can get the vibe of it, but it's not going to sound like that. She goes, okay, well, what are you going to play like? I said, well, something like this. She goes, oh, okay, well, that sounds good. I said, okay, are we good? Yeah, we're good. And then that was pretty much it. And so that's how we kind of started our friendship, and we'd run into each other all the time. The thing that Barbra and I think that what she liked about me was that I never kissed her ass.
Ah.
I always told her the truth. Like, she would ask me something like, do you like the way this sounds? And I'd say something like, well, not really. Why do you think that? Well, because of this and this. And I would just tell her the truth about things. And if I liked something, I would tell her. So when we started, I know she had a song and she wanted me to play a solo on it. She said to me, which was really cool about her, she goes, look, I don't even know if I want a saxophone solo, but we're friends. I said, could you just play a sax solo on here? And then I could see if I even like a sax solo.
Huh.
Would you do that for me? I said, sure. So I play on there, and it sounds great, by the way.
Yeah, we're going to listen to it in just a second, but I just got to ask, I mean, you hear so many, you know, tough stories about working with Barbra Streisand, but it sounds like you two click pretty well.
The thing about Barbra is that she's really honest, and she is a perfectionist, and I understand that concept because I have a little bit of that in me. So when she says to me, I just want to hear what it sounds like, would you do this? And I already know that working with her, she's going to ask me to change a million things. I already know that. So I'm a friend. I said, you know what? I will be your guinea pig. And you can, I said, if it turns out to be a guitar solo, I'll still have fun. So I did the solo, sounded great. She loved it. Then she calls me up the next morning in a panic. She goes, oh my God, you're playing the wrong saxophone.
Oh.
I said, really? She goes, yeah, you're playing the wrong saxophone. It's supposed to be a tenor, not an alto. I said, if that's true, Barbra, all the notes that you had me play, they're too high for the tenor. They're impossible to play on the tenor. This is the alto. We played the exact right saxophone. She goes, oh, okay, whew, okay, great. No problem then. It sounds great.
Let's listen.
And that was it. She loved it.
Let's listen to a little bit of the song we're talking about here. This is Kenny G and Barbra Streisand from At Last, the Duets album. This track is The Music That Makes Me Dance.
I know he's around when the sky and the ground start in ringing. I know that he's near by the thunder I hear in advance. His words alone are the words that can start my heart singing.
Now, Kenny, I've got to ask, why the name Kenny G? Where did that come from?
Well, my first manager just told me to drop the Orlick from Gorlick. So you got to drop the Ehrlich. Just go Kenny G, because people would always call me that. Like, all my friends would always call me. I mean, let's see, what do they call me on the road? Most of the guys just call me G. They go G or KG or K, or yeah, pretty much like a G-man or something like that. So it's always been a nickname in my life.
I mean,
I just said, just get rid of the Ehrlich.
Do you prefer to be called Kenny, Kenny G? What works for you?
Depends who it is.
Okay. How about me?
You could just call me Kenny.
We're getting to be friends, aren't we? I like this. This is working.
I like that, yeah. I mean, if it's a beautiful woman, I'd rather her just call me sweetheart. That works for me, too.
I got to ask, too, about your hair. Are you ever tempted to cut it? Because it's so closely connected to your sort of persona these days. What about it?
I've actually had people send me digital pictures of what I look like with different short haircuts. And, you know, I'm so, you know, you can't really look at yourself and know whether you're looking. So I would show it to people and ask them, like my two kids. Both my sons say to me, if I ever cut my hair, they are not going to be my sons anymore. You know how when the father goes, you're dead to me?
Yeah.
They look at me and they go, Dad, if you cut your hair, you're going to be dead to us. You're not going to be our father. So it's pretty tough. It's pretty tough to cut in that sense. But I guess that, you know, if it ever starts to, you know, look pretty ratty or something like that, it's not that I pay a lot of attention to it. It's naturally curly. My grandmother had ringlets, by the way.
Huh.
And so I got the hair from her, so I guess sometimes I get pretty sentimental when I look at myself in the mirror. I go, oh, it's my grandmother's hair. So I've had long hair since I was 15. It's pretty tough to change it right now, and I would just be changing it for the sake of change. I'll do it, I guess, when I organically want to, but I don't. At this point, it's not going to happen.
You know, I want to go back and end our conversation with the album, At Last, the Duets album, because on that disc, you were able to perform with one of your early musical heroes, the supergroup Earth, Wind, and Fire. How big a kick was that to actually be able to perform with a group you had admired so much as a kid?
I couldn't imagine why they even agreed to have me do it, but it was great. I think that was a Clive Davis, you know, one of his calls. You know, if Clive says, hey, we really want you to do this with that sax, but oh, they say yes. So it was, I have to take my hat off again to Clive for putting that together. And the fun thing was that I was in Japan, and Earth, Wind, and Fire was in Japan, and they had us on a talk show together, and it was the funniest thing. You know, you see those things on TV where you know, it's Lost in Translation. Oh my gosh, was that ever Lost in Translation? We had the best time.
Well, here's Kenny G and Earth, Wind, and Fire, this track, The Way You Move. Kenny G performs this weekend with the Kansas City Symphony as part of the orchestra's pop series. Shows on Friday and Saturday nights are sold out, but tickets for Sunday's 7 p.m. performance are still available. You'll find more details at kcur.org and at the symphony's website, kcsymphony.org. And Kenny, it's been a thrill to have you. Thanks for taking some time with us.
Hey, it was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
We'll see you this weekend.
I look forward.
You bet. Tomorrow on the show, with the recent NFL lawsuit, the problem of concussions is front page news. We'll look at treatment and prevention programs for youth, plus we'll have our weekend to-do list. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.